So this particular class is called I Have Also Been Cursed. This is another of Narada Muni's extraordinary pastimes. So before we begin the story, we should also note, since our subject matter is speaking about Narada Muni, how significant he is insofar as he becomes one of the five primary personalities to make up the Panchatattva in Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu Lila. Lord Chaitanya had so many devotees, in Puri, so many devotees in Mayapur, but it was Narada Muni who takes the form of Srivas Pandit. And it's also interesting to note that the Sankirtan movement was begun in Srivas Pandit's house. So anyone could have been the representative of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu in the devotee category, but Narada Muni was chosen to represent all devotees as the Panchatattva personality who represents the Vaishnavas or the devotees. That is another subject. But now we want to begin. We're starting in Canto 3 of the Srimad Bhagavatam, with the creation. So there are so many people have so many theories on the process of how this whole creation took place. And when Srila Prabhupada would speak, he would speak with the complete authority of the Vedas behind him. And he didn't feel uncomfortable if he was challenged, as we've seen in the morning class, by people who didn't believe what he believed. He didn't feel shy to say that they have not gone to the moon. And now so many people are saying that. But he was saying it when everybody firmly believed that there was no question that they must have gone to the moon. But he said, no, they cannot have gone to the moon. What was his evidence? The Vedic scriptures. The moon was too far away. They could not reach the moon. So this was very sometimes embarrassing for his disciples, because we did not have the same faith as he in the Vedic message. So we would feel a little bit pinched, because we would have to represent it. At the same time, we didn't have the background of strength and faith and firm belief that Srila Prabhupada himself had. But he would always base his claim on Shastra, not just that he had some faith, but Shastra says it. So when one devotee wanted to leave because he was felt so threatened that Srila Prabhupada was saying they didn't go to the moon, and he had a scientific mind, he was so disturbed he wanted to leave. And Srila Prabhupada said to one of his other followers, he said, I can understand that he doesn't believe me, but Shastra says it. So this is where we base our authority, on the Srimad Bhagavatam and other Vedic literatures that correlate the teachings of Krishna in this Vyasadeva in this form. So therefore we can understand from the Vedic version the process of creation, which is divided actually into 10 different divisions, different stages of the process. 6 of those processes, the stages, are considered primary, and it is Lord Vishnu who orchestrates them. And the 4 last ones are the secondary creation within the universe. And this is Lord Brahma's creation. He takes responsibility for this. So these 4 secondary divisions are, first of all the living beings in the form of trees. Then all the living beings in the lower species. These are both considered in the mode of ignorance. Then in the mode of passion, the human beings. And finally, in the mode of goodness, are the demigods. Then, after Lord Brahma has created, he is preparing the subtle creation of all of these personalities. He creates the conditions under which they will have to live. Just like if we're creating something, we're building a house. We have to first of all come, put in the footings, then we have to lay the pad, then we have to work out the brick people to come to build the walls and the roof, and everything has to be done systematically. But first there's a plan, there's a conception. Now we'll put the house, will be here. So in the mind of the person who is creating the house, He already can envision what is going to be there because he's so experienced. He knows what it will look like when it comes about. So Lord Brahma is the first person in this. This is the creation that takes place when he wakes up. In the beginning of every day of Lord Brahma, he creates. So first he creates the conditions under which we have to live. Then, from himself, he creates the four Kumaras. And when he creates these four little boys, 5 years of age, young little boys, he tells them, now, your responsibility on my behalf, I am like your father, you should go out and you should help with this process of creating everything again. But these little boy sages, they don't wish to be entangled. And so they very politely decline the demand of Lord Brahma, their father, and he becomes angry. And when he becomes angry, from between his eyebrows, in the form of his anger, Rudra is created. And so then Rudra, he's quite happy to create, but he creates bedlam. He creates so many inauspicious persons with inauspicious mentality. And so then Lord Brahma thinks how to stop him from creating. And he calls him and says to him, you should go to the Himalayas and do some practice of meditation. Because your job is actually to destroy. Now is time for to create, not to destroy. So please you go and you wait there, and when the time for destruction occurs, then you come back and you can do everything. So Rudra, he goes. And then Lord Brahma creates 10 sons. 9 of them are the 9 great sages, well known in Vedic literature. Vasishtha, Angira, Pulastra, Daksha, Kratu, Atri, Marichi, Pulaha, and Augusta. And then, from his highest, most refined quality of deliberation, he creates Narada Muni. So Narada is born from Brahma's best deliberation, and he alone can deliver to the whole of humanity the pathway going towards bhakti. Then still, he has created something, but he still is not coming quickly enough. So then Brahma thinks, and from his meditation, he creates Swayambhuva Manu and his wife Satarupa. They appear. And then Swayambhuva Manu, Satarupa, they begin the actual creation. So they have 3 sons, 2 sons, and 3 daughters. And from their sons and daughters, dynasties take place. These dynasties go in different directions. And all the different types of living beings are going to be created within these dynasties that are about to take place. So the 2 sons of Swayambhuva Manu, one is called Maharaj Uttanapad, and he is the father of Dhruva Maharaj. So he has 2 sons, and Dhruva Maharaj is the prominent one. He has another son called Priyavrata, who has his own lineage, which will come from him. Now Priyavrata, unlike the different princes that we're going to hear about in today's story, Priyavrata was preached to by Narada Muni to become renounced. Please, give this all up. Why do you bother with all of this? It will be so entangling. Everyone knows just one small family is entangling. What to speak of creating so many different types of species and generations and so forth. So Narada Muni preached to Priyavrata, and Priyavrata, like others who we'll hear about today, he was also thinking, yes, this is a good idea. I shouldn't get involved in all of this. But at this time, Swayambhuva Manu wished to also complete his services for his time. He wanted to now renounce and concentrate on his spiritual development. So he wanted his son to come and take over the kingdom, but he was unwilling. And so there was Narada on one side, who had spoken very strong words of renunciation to Priyavrata, and on the other side is his father, Swayambhuva Manu, a very highly respected personality, begging him to do this work. Narada is suggesting not to, and Swayambhuva Manu became almost hopeless. What's going to happen? You mean I can't get my freedom? I cannot retire from all of these obligations and duties? Because he was thinking, Narada Muni has convinced my son. So who should arrive then? Who would be the only person who could solve this problem? It was Lord Brahma. Because Lord Brahma is superior to both Swayambhu Vamanu and also to Narada. And Lord Brahma convinced everyone concerned that actually Priyavrata should not become a renunciate, but he should take up the Grihastha path and he should have progeny and he should have a dynasty connected to his name, royalty, and he should take the advice of his father. And Narada Muni didn't mind. He didn't feel like, oh, you know, that's not really the right thing to do. He was perfectly happy to accept this. From the three daughters of Swayambhu Vamanu, he had Akuti, Prasuti, and Devahuti. So each of these daughters also had sons, and they had sons, and they had sons. And the Srimad Bhagavatam, right up to the end of the seventh canto, and there's only 12 cantos, so the first seven cantos is delineating the pastimes from that family, from Swayambhu Vamanu's family. One story after another, they're all these family members and their dynasties and the great personalities who appeared there. So, we're going to hear today, particularly first of all, about Dhruva Maharaj, how at a young age he had a very inconceivable desire, an unrealistic desire, you could say. Just like if I said, I want to own something bigger than everything, then you would think that's the desire of a child, it's unreasonable. So you would sort of say, yes, yes, you can have that later, and give them something to play with, to occupy their mind, because you wouldn't take that very seriously, because it's not possible. Well, Dhruva Maharaj was like that, but he was a king's son. He was Uttanapad's son, he was the grandson of Swayambhu Vamanu, the great grandson of Lord Brahma himself. And so therefore, he had this desire, I want to have a kingdom greater than my great-grandfather. That's what I want. And he left his family, as we know, because of his stepmother's harsh words, and he went to the forest, and this desire grew within him, I want this kingdom. He also wanted some revenge, because he was angry at his stepmother for insulting him, because he was a prince, so he had this royal pride. But when Narada came, he came to see Dhruv, and he wanted to test him, to see what he was made of. So he came and he said to him, you're just a little boy. Why are you so upset? Just go home. There isn't any difficulty. It was just a small thing. Your stepmother, she didn't mean that. She didn't mean to upset you. You shouldn't take these things very seriously. Just go home and go on. And when you grow up, you can do whatever you want to do. And he didn't agree. And then Narada said to him, you know, it's very important in this world to learn tolerance. You have to become tolerant. So you should become tolerant of whatever your stepmother has done. And Dhruva Maharaj listened very respectfully. But then he said to Narada, he said, my dear Narada, thank you for your very fine advice. But I must tell you that your advice doesn't stay with me. It doesn't touch my heart. If you can give me some advice about how to get the kingdom I want, then I would be very interested to hear it. And he's a small boy. But Narada took this. He did not take this as being offensive. He said, all right. So after he had tested, Dhruva backwards and forwards, he told him what he should do. You follow this process. You go and do this meditation. And in 6 months, you will get the darshan of the Lord and you can ask him for what you want. So then he did that. And Dhruva Maharaj left. And then Narada Muni left. And Dhruva Maharaj practiced and practiced. He obtained what he wanted. He became the king for 36,000 years because it is in Satva Yuga. And after him he had a son. His son's name was Utkal. So Utkal was a little bit like his father because he's a great son of a great king. he also was somewhat renounced. But he had a son called Vatsara, and Vatsara had a son called Pushpara, and he had a son called Vyusta. And from Vyusta came Chakshush Manu, the next Manu for the next millennium. So millennium is an extremely long time, and the Manu's position is very important. So Chakshush Manu came in the line, in the dynasty of Dhruva Maharaj. Then came Ulmukha, from him came Pushkarai, and then came Maharaj Anga. Now, we might have heard of Anga Maharaj because he didn't have any children. And he performed a yajna, a very pious king, but when he performed it, no demigods came. And in Satya Yuga, the demigods would all come and they would take their share of the offerings. But no demigods came, and this was considered extremely inauspicious. So when the king asked the priests who had performed the sacrifice, "What's wrong? This obviously this was a very inauspicious sacrifice," they said that the reason the demigods didn't come is because you don't have a son. And the reason you don't have a son is not because of something you did in this life, but it's something that you did in your previous life. And because of this, you don't have a son. But they offered him the opportunity to have a son. And they gave him some special sweet rice, he asked, as was the custom, and he gave this to his queen, and she gave birth to a son. But his queen, Sunita, was born in the dynasty of death personified. And so the child that was born was not an auspicious child, and his name was Venu. And Venu, from the time he was born, he was incredibly cruel. He, for example, he would go and play like young boys like to play in the swimming pool together and swim and splash and play with each other. But when he was splashing and playing with the children, while no one was looking, he would push a few under the water and drown them. You can imagine, you'd feel very uncomfortable with such a child. And you know, when they were playing, perhaps they were playing bow and arrow and playing away, and he'd turn to one of his friends and shoot him and kill him. He was quite cruel. Maharaj Anga was really shocked. He had such an unpleasant child. He was harsh, he was cruel, he wasn't respectful. He had many, many bad qualities. And at first the king thought, "What can I do? I have to correct my son." He was in a lot of anxiety. So he would take him to task and punish him and try to rectify him, but it was his nature. He was like this by nature. And so everything his father did to try to curb him, correct him, didn't work. And finally his father became very, very aloof from this boy because he couldn't do anything with him. And he was causing him so much pain and so much anxiety that it was like he didn't want to see him anymore. And actually, then he started to think and he thought, it's better to have a good son than a bad son. It's better to have a son than no son. But it's better to have, obviously, a good son than a bad son. But now I'm starting to think that it's better to have a bad son than a good son. Because a bad son, you just don't want to have anything to do with family life anymore. It's too painful. You just don't want to have any dealings with this. I want to turn my attention instead to the Lord, to something transcendental. And so Maharaj Anga, he left one night. He left the palace and he disappeared. And in the morning, everyone went looking for him. They could not find him anywhere. And when they couldn't find him, they searched here and there. He just went off into the forest to lead a life of renunciation. So what to do? The sages thought very carefully, the ministers discussed, and they said, "Venu, he's not a nice person. But what are we going to do? If there's no king, then all of the miscreants will become flourishing in the kingdom. So what should we do?" And the sages thought, "He's cruel. We know he's cruel, he's proud, he's arrogant, he's a little nasty, but he's strong. So at least he will keep the hand on the Lord." So they said, "We should install him as king." So they did. And for some time it worked all right. He was so harsh and strict that people were frightened of him. They didn't want to do anything and have him punish them, so they behaved. But gradually, it didn't work so well because he became more and more proud, more and more impudent, and he started to stop the sages themselves from performing their religious duties and told them instead that they should start performing all the sacrifices, offering all respects to him. Because after all, the king is God incarnate. So no more worship in this way. You should offer everything to me. And as his arrogance grew, the sages' anger also grew. So they decided to go and speak to him and see if they could change his ways. So they went to Maharaj Anga and they said to him, "We do not like the way that you are managing the kingdom." And they told him what they wanted him to correct. And he listened very politely to them. And as soon as they had finished, he started speaking very arrogant words to them about his superiority to them. And the sages became so offended by Maharaj Raina that with very high pierced words, just by sound vibration, they killed him. And now they had killed him. Now there was no king. So what happens when there's no management, no leadership, when there's some kind of a coup d'etat or some confusion takes place in a country? You see that everyone goes rioting, goes wild, riots take place, stealing takes place, all havoc breaks loose. So similarly, this is what took place. Everybody became everything was all disturbed. So the sages thought long, and they came back to the palace where Sunita, the mother of Venu, had preserved his body in all of these very special oils that she had, because it was her son. And so they took his limbs, and Prabhupada says, you might think that this is very extraordinary, but this was the power of the sages at that time. That they were able to churn his body, to move his body in such a way that out from his body first came a very black and ugly person, who personified or embodied all the nasty bad qualities of Vena. And then they gave him somewhere to live, told him, you can go and live in the forest, please go. So he's happily he left. And then they churned again, now his purified body, and from there came Priti Maharaj and his queen Archi. So they appeared out of the body of Vena. And Prithu Maharaj is an empowered incarnation of the personality of Godhead, Shaktavesh Avatar. So Prithu Maharaj, when you read the Bhagavatam, occupies many chapters of the fourth canto. And when Prithu Maharaj left this world, he had one son called Antardhan. And he had one son called Havidhan. And Havidhan had a son called Bahisat. And this Bahisat, he became very well known as his name was changed to Prachinabahi, and he was a very famous king, still in the line coming from Dhruva Maharaj. Now Narada Muni had taken to himself, quietly to himself, a vow that he wanted to liberate all the kings in the line of Dhruva Maharaj. He didn't want any of them to degrade. He wanted them all to become elevated as much as was in his power. So he chose to visit this Bahisat, Prachina Bahisat, and we'll hear of that visit tomorrow morning. Narada Muni was determined that he was going to make that man devotional at all costs, and he put great effort into that. Prachina Bahi had 10 sons, and they were called the Prachetas. And as was the custom for anyone in the royal order, he would send his sons, like he would say, to Gurukul, we send our children to school. He would send his sons at a young age to perform all kinds of tapasya, austerity, discipline, chanting, so many different processes to purify them and qualify them to take up the weight of responsibility of kingship. So he sent his 10 boys, the Prachetas, off to the ocean to meditate under the water of the ocean. And on their way they were passing through the garden of Kailash, and they happened to meet Lord Shiva. And Lord Shiva was very happy to meet these 10 boys, because One of the qualities of them was that they worked so nicely together. They never quarreled. They never had any differences. They worked everything out together and they were so cooperative. And this was one of the things that later Lord Vishnu himself would congratulate them for. So there they were. They came across Lord Shiva and he gave them some mantras to chant. The songs of Lord Shiva are part of the fourth canto. And he told them, you go and chant these mantras, remember these mantras, do your austerities and go back and become king. Meanwhile, Narada had gone to the assembly of the Prachetas and he was telling them all about Dhruva Maharaj. And he sang three specific verses glorifying Dhruva Maharaj. And this story that I'm telling you was being told to Vidura by Maitreya. So Maitreya, at this point, he was hearing. He had not heard the whole dynasty as I have elaborated it. This comes later. But all this is at the end of the story of Dhruva Maharaj. It is said that Narada went to the Prachetas. So then Vidura said, who are the Prachetas? And that began the story of the Prachetas and King Prachinabhari. Meanwhile, one of the other sons of Lord Brahma was Daksha. So Daksha, he was one of these nine sages. And these sages were very expert in the arts of Karmakandya, or how to perform yajñas, sacrifices, ritualistic ceremonies for the purpose of obtaining a better material situation. This is called fruitive work. So he knew, he was very expert at this. How to make your family life very prosperous, how to go to heaven next birth, how to get lots of wealth and money and have no problems and so on and so forth, by these religious ritualistic ceremonies. So Daksha came from Brahma and he married one of these daughters that we heard of with Swayambhuva Manu, Prasuti, Devahuti and Akuti. He married Prasuti. And he had 16 daughters. And his youngest daughter, her name was Sati. But Sati didn't have any children. So Vidura inquired about this. Why didn't she have any children? Always there are children. So then we hear the story of why Sati had no family. And it was because Sati died at a very young age. So Maharaj Daksha, he was very, very proud and very, very proficient and very expert. And he was holding a yajna. And to that yajna, a Vedic sacrifice, he invited all the demigods and they all came. Because he was a son of Brahma, that means he was a Prajapati. He had to expand the population. So he was performing his ceremonies and functions appropriately. So all the demigods came, including Lord Brahma and Lord Shiva. And when Daksha walked into that assembly, he was like glowing. He was so effulgent and so significant. And he stood out. Such charisma he had. And when he came in, Lord Brahma didn't stand up because he was his father. He doesn't have to offer respect to his son. But Lord Shiva was deep in meditation. And he also didn't stand up to offer any respect to his father-in-law because Sati was the daughter of Daksha. So when Daksha saw this, that Lord Shiva hadn't opened his eyes or showed any particular importance to him, out from his heart came something that he was keeping to himself. Just like, say, there's somebody in this room that you really don't like and you're trying to keep it to yourself. You don't want to say anything about it, but it's burning there in your heart. I really don't like this person. And then they do something. Right, they kick you by accident, perhaps when they're passing by. And you turn around and you say, listen, I'm not angry or anything, but if you ever do that to me again, all of this anger comes out. So this is what happened with Daksha. He said to everyone present, he said, I am not speaking out of envy. Please do not think that. I am not offended or anything like that. But I have to tell you the bad qualities of Lord Shiva. And then he started. And he started speaking such terrible things about Lord Shiva. And all Lord Shiva's disciples and followers were there. So of course they were feeling very uncomfortable. And he spoke so many things and he said, he's my son-in-law, he doesn't offer respect, he's dirty. Look at the way he dresses. He wears skulls around his neck. Can you imagine a son-in-law like this? I didn't want him to marry my daughter. I had no interest in this. It was only because of Lord Brahma. He asked me to do this. Otherwise, I would never have made this arrangement. And he went on and on. And when he spoke so many bad things about Lord Shiva, then he felt very offended and he said, anyway, I don't wish to take part in this anymore. And he stormed out. And then all the followers of Lord Shiva jumped up. And they were very offended and they started to say things, criticizing Daksha and saying, he's like this, he's like that, so many things. And then the followers of Daksha stood up and they started saying things to the followers of Lord Shiva. And a big, unpleasant, inauspicious circumstance took place. And in the midst of this, Lord Shiva stood up, having said nothing, and he walked out. And all of his followers followed him. And then the sages, in a very awkward way, they had to complete this yajna. Then, sometime later, Daksha decided to do it again. But one of Daksha's curse was, when he left, he cursed Lord Shiva. He said, I curse him that he will not have any part, any benefit from these sacrifices. So the next time he performed the yajna, he didn't have any offering set aside for Lord Shiva. There was no post position for him, no benediction, no gift to him, no gratitude being shown to him. And he invited everyone to come, and they were coming again. It was a big social event in the upper regions. And Sati saw all of her family members and so many different personalities all going to this wonderful social event, and she started to say to Lord Shiva, oh, my dear husband, look, everyone's going to my father's house. I want to go too. Please, this is going to be such a nice occasion. Please, can I go? And Lord Shiva said, no, it will not be good for you to go, because this enmity between your father and me has not been healed. And so if you go, it will be very, very, very bad. Because he will become angry with you because of your relationship with me. And that will be very painful to you. And Sati tried by various means to change Lord Shiva's opinion. And he said, no, I don't want you to go. And Sati, it describes, she looked at Lord Shiva as if she was going to burn him with her eyes. She was so angry. And she looked at him and looked at him. This is a very strong lady's response. And then she walked from room to room to room to room, pacing backwards and forwards, backwards and forwards, backwards and forwards. And then she walked out the door. And when she walked out the door, Lord Shiva understood she is determined, she's going to go. So he sent Nandi so she could go in style, and all of his followers, as if she had been invited. She was not invited. So she arrived at her family house. She came in. Her mother was so happy to see her. Her sisters were so happy to see her. They were all embracing her and hugging her. And all the ladies were so happy. But her father just ignored her like she wasn't there. He didn't want to see her. And then she looked and she saw that he was insulting Lord Shiva by not offering any oblations to him in the sacrificial fire. And then Sati became angry. She had become angry with her husband. She now became angry with her father. And she said, look what you're doing. Don't you know who Lord Shiva is? He's the greatest personality. Everybody worships Lord Shiva. And you're offending him by not offering anything like this? And she went on and on and on speaking to her father. And finally she said, sometimes I get called Dakshini, because I'm your daughter, but I don't want my name to be linked with you anymore. So I'm giving back, as Srila Prabhupada was saying yesterday, I'm giving back this body to you. So she sat down, she chanted mantras, and fire came from her body. And this fire, this yogic, mystical fire, consumed her whole body, and she disappeared. Now, how do you think all Lord Shiva's followers felt about this? This was horrific. So they became furious and they took up arms and they went to attack. But Bhrigu Muni, who was the priest, He chanted some oblations and threw some offering in the fire, and these powerful demigods appeared to protect the whole arena, and Lord Shiva's followers were forced to leave. So they went straight back to Lord Shiva and they told him, "Your wife just committed suicide." And Lord Shiva became most angry. In the most angry way, Lord Shiva, he is devastation. It's his speciality. So he chanted some mantras, he shouted, he pulled the hair from his, and he made this attempt, and a huge, forceful, powerful being came. He told this personality to go back and destroy everything. And he did. And what was his name?
Virabhadra.
He went straight back to the sacrificial fire and he threw everything everywhere. They smashed everything. They attacked anyone who had said anything or shown any signs of partiality towards Lord Shiva. And finally, he was to kill Daksha. And he tried to kill Daksha, but Daksha was so powerful he couldn't kill him. And then he took the instrument that's used to cut the head off the animal as part of the mantra chanting. And this is to strengthen the power of the mantras. There is a test in which they use animals. It's not animal slaughter. It's not something inhuman. It's a particular scientific part of yajna many, many, many thousands and thousands of years ago when people were so highly refined and is not recommended in Kali Yuga. But he took this instrument and he took off Daksha's head and threw his head into the fire. Finished. And Daksha fell down dead. Then they left, having destroyed everything. And all the demigods now felt very uncomfortable. But they went to Lord Brahma, and Lord Brahma told them, "You can't expect anything good to happen if you blaspheme saintly persons. Nothing good will come from it. Only bad will come from it. You have done these offenses to Lord Shiva, and quite naturally, he has responded in this way." So they spoke. Brahma said, "I will go with you and we will speak to Lord Shiva." So they went to Lord Shiva. They offered their prayers and apologies. Lord Shiva, he accepted them. He came back to the yajna and he told them, "Let Daksha be replaced his head with the head of a goat." And they had the mystic power to give Daksha a new life. And in his new life, he had a goat's head. And when he came back, it was like as if he had been sleeping. They could revive his life. That's how powerful their mantra chanting was. Then Daksha realized what had happened, what he had done, what confusion had taken place. And he became very, very sorry. And that his daughter had been killed as a result of his actions. So Daksha, in his next life, not this life, in the next Manu, Chakshusha Manu, in his time, when Daksha took birth again, he took birth as the one son of the 10 Prachetas. The Prachetas had one wife, and they had one son, and that son's name was Daksha. So Daksha appeared again, just as Narada Muni appeared again. And he had the same mentality, because whatever mentality we leave this world in, we will carry that with us to our next life. So Daksha had the same mentality. He was again considered very materially expert, very competent. He became a Prajapati. His business was to procreate the world, to have sons, daughters, to generate population in this way. And he took part in this again. So then Marissa was the name of his mother. So then Daksha, he also went to perform austerities. And he performed austerities, and while performing those austerities, he had two ways he could create, from his mind, or he could create seminally. So first he created what he could through his mind, but he wasn't completely satisfied. So then he went to perform austerities. And then the Lord came to him and blessed him with a very nice wife and said, "Through this wife, you can have so many children." And Daksha became very happy. So Daksha, his wife's name was Akshini. And he told him, the Lord blessed him. He said, your endeavor to fulfill this desire to procreate, have more progeny, is for the welfare of the world. So unite with your wife and give birth to hundreds and thousands of children who will also be captivated by my illusory energy, just like you. And they will engage in this way just like yourself. But because of my mercy to you and to them, they will also be able to give me presentations in devotion. This was the blessing he received. You'll have so many sons like you. They will be materialistic. But some of them, they will also, like you, by my mercy, they will be devotional. So then the Lord disappeared. And Daksha began his procreation. And inconceivable to us, he had 10,000 sons. 10,000 sons. How can we imagine having 10? If somebody has, five sons, or four sons, three sons, they get in the newspaper and everybody thinks this is amazing. But he had 10,000 sons. And their name was the Hariyashvas. And Daksha was very happy with these sons, and he encouraged them to please go as I did, and as all the kings in the line of Dhruva Maharaj before have done. Please go and perform your austerities, and then you come back, you also become kings, and you can rule, and you can have family, and so on and so forth. So these Hariyashvas, they went to a place called Narayan Saras. And this was the place where they were going to perform their austerities. So when they got there, they took their bath and they did all the various things that one should do. And then they prepared to practice their austerities. Now, meanwhile, while this was happening, Narada Muni heard about these boys and heard that they were very nice. They were particularly nice, particularly well-behaved, particularly well-mannered, very pious young men. And he thought to himself, why do these nice young men have to get entangled in all of the complexities of family life? Let me give them some instructions. So Narada went there, and he did something very cryptic. He came up to the boys, they were all there, they offered their respects to him. He approached them, and the great sage Narada said this to the boys. He said, my dear boys, you have not seen the extremities of the earth. You are young, naive. You have not seen everything. There is a kingdom where only one man lives, and there is a hole, a deep hole, so deep, from which entering that hole, no one ever comes out. And there is a woman there who is extremely unchaste and adorns herself with various attractive dresses. And the man who lives there is her husband. In that kingdom, there is a river. Now, a river, it flows like this, right? Or it flows like this. But this river flows in both directions. We have not seen a river like this. It flows in both directions, and there is a wonderful home there made of 25 materials. There is a swan that vibrates various sounds, and there is an automatically revolving object made of sharp razors and thunderbolts. You have not seen all of this. Therefore, you are inexperienced boys without advanced knowledge. How will you create progeny? The boys heard this very cryptic, mystical explanation. They were so intelligent. As soon as they heard this, and Narada added one more point, he said, alas, your father is omniscient, but you do not know his actual order. Without knowing the actual purpose of your father, how will you create progeny? So these two messages he gave. And the boys heard these enigmatic words and they considered them with their natural intelligence without any help from anyone else. And they understood what this allegory was meant to be. So we can, you can ask me what that is later. I'll leave you with that. But when they heard this and they understood what it was, they decided that actually they didn't want to do this. They didn't want to enter into this situation. So they all believed in Narada's instructions and came to the same conclusion. And having accepted him as their spiritual master, they circumambulated him and followed the path by which one never returns to this earth. They left. They didn't go back home. And when Daksha found out that his 10,000 sons had been preached to by Narada and they had all left, he was very upset, needless to say. But he was a Prajapati, so he could do it again. So again he prepared himself, and again he had progeny. And this time, having heard about this and having seen what had happened, he decided to have some sons again, and he had 1,000 sons this time. So when Prajapati Daksha was lamenting for his lost children, Lord Brahma pacified him with instructions. Therefore Daksha begot 1,000 more children in the womb of his wife, and this time his sons were known as the Savalasvas. Now Daksha, although he was so clever, he wasn't that clever. Because what he did was, when it came time for his sons to go to do their austerities and penances, he sent his boys off to the same place. So he wasn't entirely very artful in this regard. And off his boys went in the same way. They went to do their austerities at Narayan Saras, and when he heard about this, Narada Muni also went there. And when he got there, he approached these sons of Prajapati Daksha, and they were engaged in tapasya to beget children, and he spoke enigmatic words to them too. What he said to them was, he said, "O sons of Daksha, listen carefully to my words. You are very affectionate to your older brothers, the Hariyashvas. Therefore, why not follow their path?" A brother is aware of the principles of religion and he follows always the footsteps of his elder brother. Because of being highly elevated, such a pious brother gets the opportunity to associate and enjoy with demigods who are all affectionate to their brothers. So these Savalasvas, they listened to this and they received the merciful glance of Narada, which never goes in vain. And as soon as they had heard this and received Narada's glance, they too decided to leave, and they left. Now, how do you think Daksha felt about this? He was so upset. He wasn't upset and sad. He was furious. He saw so many inauspicious signs around. He knew something very inauspicious has happened. And when he heard from various people that his second sons had all gone and followed the path of their older brothers, he became very angry. He became angry at Narada and he almost fainted in lamentation. Then Narada went to tell him. He came to inform him that his sons had all gone. And Daksha, you can just imagine, they're like something like brothers. And he was so furious and he was just trembling in anger. And then he started to speak so many words to Daksha. He said to Narada, "You wear the dress of a saintly person, but you're not at all a saint. Although I am now a grihastha, I am a saintly person. By showing my sons the path of renunciation, you have done me an abominable injustice. My sons were not at all freed from their three debts. Indeed, they did not properly consider their obligations. O personality of sinful action, Narada Muni, you have obstructed their progress towards good fortune in this world and the next, because they are still indebted to the saintly persons, demigods, and their father. Now, Srila Prabhupada will speak very strong words in these purports, but we don't have time to read them. Then Daksha said, thus committing violence against other living entities and claiming to be an associate of the Lord, you are defaming the Lord. You needlessly created a mentality of renunciation in innocent boys. And therefore you are shameless and devoid of compassion. How could you travel with the personal associates of the Supreme Lord? Now here is where Srila Prabhupada is about to say, I have also been cursed. Then Daksha continued. He said, all the devotees of the Lord but you are kind to the conditioned souls and eager to benefit others. Although you wear the dress of a devotee, you create enmity with people who are not your enemies, or you break friendship and create enmity between friends. Are you not ashamed of posing as a devotee while performing these abominable actions? If you think that simply by awakening a sense of renunciation, that's enough to detach one from this world, I must say that unless full knowledge is awakened, simply changing dresses as you have done cannot possibly bring detachment. I live in household life with my family and children and honestly follow the Vedic injunctions by engaging in fruitive activities to enjoy life. I have performed all kinds of yajnas, but you have given me great displeasure by misguiding my sons, for no reason, to the path of renunciation. This cannot be tolerated anymore. You have made me lose my sons once, and now you have again done the same inauspicious thing. Therefore you are a rascal who does not know how to behave towards others. You may travel all over the universe, but I curse you that you can travel anywhere, but you will never have a residence. Srila Prabhupada says, because Prajapati Daksha was a Griha Medhi who wanted to remain in household and life, he thought that if Narada Muni could not remain in one place, but had to travel all over the world, that would be the greatest punishment for him. He wanted to have a house and his family and his family's family and his family's family and a dynasty. He was thinking like this, so he thought the worst thing I could do to Narada Muni was to cut him off from all of that, because this is the greatest happiness in life. Actually, however, such a punishment is a boon for a preacher. A preacher is known as Paribhajakacharya, an acharya or teacher who always travels for the benefit of human society. Prajapati Daksha cursed Narada by saying that although he had the facility to travel all over the universe, he would never be able to stay in any place. In the Parampara system from Narada Muni, says Srila Prabhupada, I have also been cursed. Although I have many centers that would be suitable places of residence, I cannot stay anywhere, for I have been cursed by the parents of my young disciples. Since the Krishna consciousness movement was started, I have traveled all over the world 2 or 3 times a year. And although I am provided comfortable places to stay wherever I go, I cannot stay anywhere for more than 3 days or a week. But I do not mind this curse by the parents of my disciples. But now, says Srila Prabhupada, very, very cleverly he's telling us, he says, now it is necessary that I stay in one place to finish another task. This is the translation of the Srimad Bhagavatam. So if my young disciples, especially those who have taken sannyas, would take charge of traveling all over the world, it may be possible for me to transfer the curse of the parents of these young preachers. And then I can sit down conveniently in one place for the work of translation. So this is Srila Prabhupada's mood. He was traveling everywhere. And as we heard, it wasn't that Srila Prabhupada was an antagonistic kind of a person. a person who liked confrontation, who liked to cause people trouble and pain. It was not that, as Daksha is criticizing in his anger. He's criticizing Narada Muni. But Narada Muni and Srila Prabhupada wanted to bring everyone to the path of devotion to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. This was their mission. And so therefore, to do this, he was prepared to run the risk of inconveniencing Daksha. And let's hear, Daksha, he gets over it. Don't worry for those poor parents who are thinking to themselves, what a horrible curse this is, or what a terrible thing could be done to my son. But actually, anyone who's here, it's already been done to your son. Because they're here. Otherwise they would not be here. They would be out somewhere doing something else. Maybe something very harmful to themselves. So then, Prajapati Daksha decided, at the request of Lord Brahma, who pacified him. This is somehow or other the Lord's arrangement. Be peaceful, don't worry. He said to him, now you know what you can do. It's very simple. You don't have any more sons. You have daughters. You have daughters, because daughters can't take up the path of renunciation in the same way. So don't worry, you'll have no worry from Narada Muni anymore. You just have daughters. So then Daksha had 60 daughters, and they were extremely beautiful, extremely chaste, and then he married them off to many, many different personalities, and they gave birth to so many children. And Daksha's process of his progenitor work was taken care of in this way. Now, I'll read one last point here about Narada Muni. It may be asked why Narada Muni stayed in the presence of Prajapati Daksha and tolerated all of his accusations and all his curses. Was that for Daksha's deliverance? The answer is yes. Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says that after being insulted by Daksha, Narada Muni could have left immediately, but he purposefully stayed to hear all of Daksha's strong words so that Daksha could be able to say them all, and this would relieve him of his anger. Just like if you're angry at somebody and they walk out, then you keep your anger. But if you can say to them, this is what I think of you, in so many strong words, then perhaps your anger will be resolved, because it is all out now. So Narada was thinking like this. He stayed to hear the words of Daksha, to pacify Daksha by releasing his anger. Prajapati Daksha was not an ordinary man. He had accumulated the results of many pious activities. Therefore, Narada Muni expected that after delivering his curse, Daksha, satisfied and freed from his anger, would repent for his misbehavior and thus also get a chance to become a Vaishnava and be delivered. When Jagayan Matai offended Lord Nityananda, Lord Nityananda stood by tolerantly. Therefore, both brothers fell at his lotus feet and repented. Consequently, they later became perfect Vaishnavas. So this is the mission of Narada Muni. Sometimes it feels to one, depending on what position you're in. If you're the parent, you would think, oh, this is very bitter. Just think, someone is coming and teaching renunciation to my sons and they're just leaving home. They haven't fulfilled their obligations to me. But if you are the person who is being released from material entanglement, you might be feeling quite differently. You might be feeling extremely grateful for these instructions. And perhaps, if you had that good fortune, then if you kept steady on your path, and we've seen this so many times, then at a later date, your parents come around and they think, actually, this was probably the best thing that ever happened to our family. So whether it is the parents who have the determination for spiritual culture, or whether it is the children who give their parents the determination for spiritual culture, at all costs, we have to continue to try to follow this path of the path from which one never returns to this material world. This is the path that is being outlined here by Narada Muni. So I'll stop here. If anyone has any questions, they can ask. Yes.
Mother, in Telugu Bhagavatam, I've heard that Narada was cursed by Lord Brahma after he preached to the four Kumaras that they should not entangle themselves into family life.
But Narada appeared after the Kumaras. So I don't know where that comes from. I cannot speak on that. There are so many different times that these passings take place, and each time somewhat differently. So I cannot comment either way on that. Yes.
We're touching here a lot on the family life and renunciation.
Yes.
This morning you were saying how there's a lot of benefits in family life. At the same time, there's disadvantages if one gets caught up in the expansion propensity.
Yes.
So on the one hand, we hear, like there's that verse, that one should renounce at 50 and take sannyas.
Yes.
And on the other hand, we hear, like Lord Chaitanya said, he forbid sannyas in Kali Yuga. And Srila Prabhupada says, maybe in the fourth canto somewhere, that if one is fixed up in his grihastha life and is very Krishna conscious, then that's as good as sannyas.
Yes. So he also says that amongst the followers of Lord Chaitanya, most of them were householders.
So if one is very Krishna conscious in the grihastha life and is preaching, etc., and does one have to take sannyas still, or can stay in grihastha life? Or
I definitely wouldn't be the right person to say that one has to take sannyas. You're asking the wrong person. You have to ask a sannyasi that. But Srila Prabhupada would speak that. We speak the principles. The principles are necessary. Renunciation is necessary. Not that one should not become a grihastha, but renunciation is important. So when one becomes a grihastha, the tendency is to say, this is my son, this is my daughter, this is my husband, and this is not your daughter, your son, it's mine. So this ahankar and the mamata becomes very much, I am mine, this is mine. So therefore it is said, even Srila Prabhupada said, that in the grihastha ashram, 25% chance to go back to Godhead. And as a brahmachari, of course we're not speaking about a duplicitous person, but a person who lives a simple, single life, he's a 75% chance. There's a higher possibility of this ahankar and mamata not getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. Because it's not only your children, then you think about when they get married, and then their children, and then it goes on and on. So therefore Narada, he's speaking here of course to Daksha, who was the emblem of this. He was attached. We heard how he was attached in his first appearance. He was attached to fruitive work. So therefore Narada wanted to correct this. No, the purpose of life isn't to try to enjoy this life. The purpose of life is to try to learn to love Krishna. So if somebody is in the householder situation, Grihetaka, Vanetaka, Sadahari, Boledaka, whether you're this, this isn't the main thing. The main thing is to take very seriously to the process of devotional service. But the more distractions that come along, quite simple, it's a simple formula, it gets a little harder and a little harder and a little harder. But still, in this particular age, generally speaking, Srila Prabhupada, I remember he wrote us a letter when we were in Hong Kong, and he said that we had just arrived in Hong Kong, we had just been married, and he said, it's good that you're there as householders preaching. He said, actually a householder can preach better than a sannyasi in this place, because everyone is a householder. So they won't be interested in listening to a sannyasi. He was saying this to encourage us. It's not altogether true, but he was giving this encouragement that as a householder you can do many valuable things, because most people are householders. So most people don't want their children to be renounced. They don't want their husband to leave them. They don't want any of these things. So therefore when they see a renounced person, they feel a little, especially in the Indian culture because they know what it means. They know all of these things. But when they see a grihastha, then they know, oh, this is somebody like us. So that can give them some, he said you'll be a good example for them. They can adjust and mold their lives according to our principles. So this is what is wanted, that we adjust and mold our lives according to Krishna conscious principles. And it's definitely harder the more things you have on your plate that aren't necessarily going to mold that way. But you see wonderful examples of people who have raised their children very strictly. Their children grow up, they become very powerful devotees. If we didn't do that, how would we have generations and generations of devotees? So it's somebody's work. It's somebody's work. So we have it as our work. So we have to do it as nicely as we can. So renunciation is also there. I think there's some part where Prabhupada mentions this, that renunciation is also there in the grihastha ashram. You still have to follow principles of renunciation. You know, so therefore it isn't considered that you have to leave all of it. It's essential that you leave. But it's encouraged for the preaching that people become free of these things and they go. But on a practical level, it may or may not be a practical thing to do. And Srila Prabhupada was also very practical. You know, he would emphasize the principle, then he would talk practically with the individuals concerned. Any other? Yes.
And Sri, when our loved ones don't come to similar realizations about the soul and about the nature of our duty in this material world, when they continue to commit offences and sinful activities which you know aren't good for their spiritual progress, and you try and preach to them but they aren't receptive to that, how do you deal with that situation? It's very saddening.
Sometimes you have to keep a little bit of a distance, because from a distance you can be more friendly, and if you're too close you'll feel compelled to say something, and maybe they're not ready to hear yet. I was just thinking, my mother, this year she's 90 years old. And my husband was saying when we were driving back to the place where we were staying, perhaps there are only four people in this room, maybe there are more, but four people in this room who have met Srila Prabhupada, and she's one of them. Now that all sounds very wonderful, but there was many long years that she wasn't interested in anything to do with Krishna. She felt also that it wasn't exactly right that we had given up so many things and taken a path that was Indian. But now, over the last 4 or 5 years, she's 90, minus 4 or 5, it's quite old, she started chanting japa. And she doesn't really understand why or what it is. She just knows a little about Srila Prabhupada because she met him. And so once a week now, 85 years old, we ring her once a week and read to her from the Lilamrita. And she's already been through the whole Lilamrita once, and she's going through it the second time. And because she's so elderly and her memory is almost faded, she doesn't remember that she's heard it before. So everything she hears is fresh for a short time. So she's got quite a blessing there. So we, you know, had to wait a long time. Sometimes you have to wait a long time. But it's part of the mood of a devotee that if that's what's required, I'll wait. But still, there are many times when I was young and a new devotee who was protecting my own faith, when I would argue with her, when she would say something that didn't comply philosophically, and we would argue back in a polite way, and then we chose, okay, we have some distance between, so we will speak about other things. So this is my experience, and I'm sure everyone here has had a different experience in this way, dealing with their family, and how to help their family, or how to avoid their family being intolerant. but generally speaking, I'd say more than not, parents come around over time if you treat them correctly. And part of treating them correctly is to understand that they're my parents. They look at me and think, listen, I remember when you were born. And you're trying to tell me something? So, you know, but patience wears away at that. Once determined. The first thing they have to understand is that you're serious. Once they know that you're serious and they see it's good for you, then after that, then they will become perhaps more tolerant, more liberal in their own understanding of things. Any other points? Yes.
Mataji, we understand that if parents do not become devotees,
yes,
but if the Narasimhadeva's instructions
keep yeah. Allah
Maharaj,
yeah.
that the parents
are liberated.
Also delivered, yeah.
Exactly.
What kind of liberation is that? Or do they also become devotees?
I think you wouldn't be able to put, like, most things in the Vedic culture, they're not like a kind of so rigid like that. What kind of liberation depends on the individual case, because sometimes parents of devotees have at the last moment before death, Srila Prabhupada used to speak of one devotee, Kartikeya, in the very early days, whose mother was very inimical. He was one of Srila Prabhupada's servants, an American boy, and when his mother was dying, she said, "So what is this Hare Krishna?" And she left. So Srila Prabhupada said she was awarded a very high destination. And somebody else, you know, there's many different stories like that. So, but liberation generally means that at least they've gone upwards. They've gone upwards to the heavenly planets. Because again, Srila Prabhupada has said, if someone performs some devotional activities, that they're not agyata sukriti, they're not completely devotionally performed, they're definitely pious activities they're performing. So pious activities, you achieve elevation. So it would depend on the individual, I would think. But definitely that was what I went on for so many years. I have to be a good devotee, because if I'm a good devotee, she'll be liberated anyway. So I don't have to, if she doesn't understand, that's all right. But I have to stay, I have to stick. I have to be strong, because if I care about them, if I don't care about them, I don't care about myself, then no problem. But if I do care, then I can do that for them. And they may not think of it as anything. They may think that it's a worthless gift, but you know the value.
From our point of view, let's say if the son becomes, a son or daughter becomes a pure devotee,
yes,
but the parents haven't, but they have pious
yes.
activities, and therefore, you know, they may have a chance to ascend to heavenly planets. How much is the son's or daughter's desire that the parents should not attain the heavenly planet? Because we know that it's
very strong. It's very strong.
How much does that influence their next destination?
Very strongly, because Krishna fulfills the desires of his devotees. As we saw with Narada, he desired that these boys in the heavenly planets should not be in the heavenly planets, they should be in Goloka Vrindavan, and there they were. So we can pray like that very strongly, that I wish the best for them. They're near and dear to me, please, you know, give some wonderful arrangement for them, and Krishna will take care of them. Yes.
We were talking before about grihastha life and renunciation. I was just wondering, in some of the conversations with today, and also your husband's class, talking about we should only be attached to Krishna, or that you were just saying in grihastha life, you know, that the problem is you say, like, my husband. But I was just wondering, in the position of a woman, that my understanding is that you should be attached to the husband, because the husband actually takes you back to Godhead. So assuming
yes.
the husband is a devotee,
yes.
to say my husband is actually the ideal position, or just so your husband was talking about
yes.
being only attached to Krishna. So I was wondering, oh no, I've just got married
yeah.
and I'm attached to my husband.
Yeah.
Oh no, what am I going to do?
But if you're attached to your husband thinking that he's my husband, rather than saying my husband, this is my husband, or he's my husband. Yes, that's the thing. Then you see, if you get married and it's just only a mundane relationship, it will go like this, right? And you'll be like this to each other, and Krishna will be like that. And if the marriage is actually spiritually based, you'll go like this together in the same direction towards Krishna. And then there's a very nice rapport, because you're like, it's said in Devahuti's, in the teachings to Devahuti, that the husband and wife should be like master and servant. There should be respect shown to the husband, but simultaneously they should be like very close friends. But you might say, oh, we're very close friends, we have similar dispositions. But that's not really what's being spoken of here, because something can happen and your dispositions can change. You know, if it's just a compatibility on the mundane level, something can make that different. But if the compatibility comes from the fact that we both want the same thing, and we're doing it together, then there's like a team, then it becomes very strong. So Krishna has to be in the center. The duty of the wife is to serve the husband, but why? For whose pleasure? For her pleasure? That's called Grihamedi. If it's not for my pleasure, it's for the pleasure of Krishna. The same activity is taking place. So here, Narada Muni is talking to these boys about renunciation and condemning household life. But then, with Priyavrata, for example, when he speaks to him like that, Lord Brahma comes in and says, no, no, he has some duty to perform. So he should take his household life. He should do it very nicely. And he did. And he attained the same result. But the idea of going to where one never returns means that I don't want my husband or myself to stay here. We should go together towards Krishna. And then you harmonize these two things that seem to be contradictory.
So Manji, does that mean that you don't think when if you serve your husband, you're not saying I'm serving this, you're not for your pleasure, and but also not for your husband's pleasure, just for Krishna's pleasure?
For your husband's pleasure.
For your husband's pleasure.
For your husband's pleasure, but he's serving, yes. You're serving your husband for his pleasure. He's taking that and offering that on. Srila Prabhupada mentioned that to me. He said, you should serve your husband. Because I was asking, should I? And I was trying to get a picture. He said, you should serve your husband. And he looked at my husband. We were a little bit, kind of like, a little bit flimsy at the time. And he said, and you serve your spiritual master. So there's a succession there. So then the wife's not in the position to say to the husband, you should serve your spiritual master. She's underneath. But he's got a responsibility then to take that on. And Srila Prabhupada, in a very affectionate way, in a very, like a way where he's very expert and fatherly, he said to me, and if you think that your husband is incompetent, then you just come to me and I will take care of you. So he smoothed the edges and sort of softened the heart, because we're thinking, him, he's above me. I'm But the principle is there, and then you try to apply it. And then the application, and there's so many things have to be worked out. But we go back to, it's like that's the standard. And so we try to move towards that. And when something's in the way, we do the best we can with it, because we can't be perfect. But we have a direction, an aim. Like if you're shooting arrows, right, there's a target over there. You don't shoot over here. Shoot in that direction. So we try our best. And this is Kali Yuga. And we're not even brought up in that culture. So we just do what we can. Yes.
What is the duty of the daughter towards the parents and the brothers?
Oh, now you're getting too complicated for me. You'll have to read the Mahabharata and tell us all. Any other questions? Yes.
You were saying about Narada was listening to Daksha in order for him to relieve his anger.
Yes.
So how is that related to Vaishnava Parada? Because one person may just be very frustrated and they're just venting their frustration.
Daksha was a very, very exalted person.
And also Narada was the one.
And Narada, yes. And Narada knew what he had done. He understood what he had done. And they are also, they're all like brothers in the sense they've all come from Lord Brahma. So Daksha was an elevated personality. So it wasn't just like a petty person venting their anger. It was, and if you think about it for a while, I mean, he took all of his sons, you know. So he stayed there. He wanted to deliver Daksha as well, but he couldn't because Daksha was attached to this path of fruitive activities. So it's said actually at the end of that chapter that he delivered so many people in the family of Dhruva Maharaj, but he couldn't deliver Daksha. Why? Because that was Daksha's purpose. He was, his function was to perform his yogas, and so he continued to do so. Anything else? Alright, yes.
You were saying that, you know, in a Krishna conscious relationship, the wife should be desire to serve the husband and be submissive. So, but you know, we see a tendency in Kali Yuga that the woman wants to be equal with the man. So in the Vedic culture, should the wife, like say there's some argument, you know, say between the wife and the husband, they've got different opinions. Should the wife always, you know, even if she thinks she's right with her opinion, should she always make that
These are starting to get into questions I could get into trouble for. This half of the room is ladies and half is men. I'm not quite sure which side to say. I think these are the kind of questions, they're not exactly philosophical. So then they're more or less like cultural questions. So they don't apply equally to everyone, if you understand what I mean. If I say this, then the men feel this way, then the ladies feel like that. So they're best to be discussed individually. And then you can think about them more. And ask people who are married. Because the husband has to work out how to deal with a womanly nature. And the wife has to work out how to deal with the man's nature. And then on top of all that, it's Kali Yuga. So you see all the women are laughing when you say that the women should, you know, be temperate. And the men are all going, yes! I know just what you're talking about. And also I've said that I should be honest, so I have to be careful. Because I'm on this side. Yes. One last question. Yes.
It's not exactly a question, but I always got the impression that yes, the wife served the husband so that it could work harmoniously, the household life could work harmoniously in Krishna consciousness, but it wasn't that the wife was less respected. It was just that the respect was shown in a different way. They have different functions.
They have different functions.
And a woman also guides the man, but in a more subtle way.
Yes.
By her...
There's actually Shastric, there's stories you can read that give you hints into these things. And Srila Prabhupada said, for example, that Draupadi was so powerful, she was controlling 5 husbands. So it wasn't that women have all the same nature and temperament, but they know how to work in harmony for the support of the whole. And generally, as a general principle, it's considered that the husband is more advanced than the wife. And if the wife is more advanced than the husband, if she really is very advanced, she'll feel very humble, so she won't want to push herself forward as I'm more advanced than you. So, and her businesses, and this is a difficulty of Kali Yuga, is that the women, when they're chaste by their shyness and their restraint, they control their husband in a different way. But in Kali Yuga, this restraint and shyness valve has been opened. Srila Prabhupada would speak about this often. They're liberated. Now they can get out there and do everything the same. And he would feel sorry for them. When he saw the lady driving the crane or something, he would think, the poor thing, the poor man who has to do it, and now the poor lady who has to do it. And she's thinking, this is a pleasure for me, I'm equal now to the men. So these are characteristics of Kali Yuga. You can't really expect to turn them away. You have to work out how to purify them. But in the Indian culture, Vedic culture, when it is working properly, quite naturally, a protected woman takes a subordinate position underneath the husband. Quite naturally, you see it in so many situations. But Kali Yuga is also striking in India. So even in India today, you find so many bad marriages as well. So many. So because it's like throwing a dice and you don't know what you're going to get, that's why Narada Muni was saying to those young boys, are you sure you want to take this trouble? And they said, no, we're not sure. And then he was able to free them from this. But we who have taken this trouble now have to work it out. And we also have to take the same path of progress spiritually. So more than that, you'll have to ask in another forum. Right. Okay. Thank you. Hare Krishna.